Support for Here and Now comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Peter O'Dowd. This is Here and Now. Parts of the Great Plains and Midwest are flooding again today after severe storms dumped several inches of rain in Missouri and Kansas in the last 24 hours. Parts of Oklahoma are under as much as 5 feet of water. Officials there say at least one person drowned after driving around a barricade. And there are stunning videos of water rescues, stranded drivers plucked out of cars, and residents being pulled from their homes. Here's sound from KFOR's TV news chopper in Oklahoma City as bystanders rescue a woman who is clinging to a tree in rushing floodwater.
We don't know how this lady ended up in the water. She looked like she had car keys in her mouth, but the first time she went underwater, she lost those, of course. And so thankfully to these three bystanders, we think, they just saved her life.
But rain is not the only problem. At least 32 tornadoes were reported in Kansas and Missouri yesterday, and two deaths in Missouri were blamed on the weather. Let's bring in Stephanie Abrams. She's a meteorologist for the Weather Channel. Stephanie, thanks for speaking with us.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Those water rescues from Oklahoma are just shocking. How bad has it been there, and is the risk over for people?
The risk is definitely not over. And the problem is they've just been getting soaked. Now, even if you go back to winter, remember up in Iowa, we had all that snowmelt, you know, and all the rain. It's just been never ending if you go back to winter. And if you look just back over the last couple of days, I mean, in a 24-hour period, I remember in southeastern Kansas the other day, we had 7+ inches of rain.
Wow.
In just a 24-hour period. So you're talking, you know, twice the monthly rainfall in some spots.
It's also tornado season. Dozens of tornadoes reported across the region this week. Is that normal for this time of year?
It is. You know, May is usually the most prolific when it comes to tornadoes. If you look at the average, I mean, the 3-year average is 296 tornadoes in May, which is the highest of all the months. So we're also setting up a pattern. Listen, it's going to get really hot in the southeast, big high pressure in the southeast. That's directing moisture into the plains, the Midwest. And so unfortunately, they're going to see a repeat of the heavy rain and the severe weather.
We have been reporting on the heavy rain throughout the Midwest throughout the last several weeks. The Mississippi and Missouri rivers are very full. What is the risk there for future flooding?
Well, the problem here also is for farming, right? So we have spoken to farmers who are saying some people might not even be able to get their seeds in the ground. It's just so wet. They've had no time to dry out. So for farming, which affects all of us in the agriculture, that's a problem. And then again, just more flooding. I mean, as we head through today, even through the end of this week, we're going to see more rounds of rain coming in, and you're going to see rivers rise and a lot of people going on vacation for the holiday. And my biggest concern is people that, A, are just not familiar with the area, and B, try to drive through those floodwaters.
Why is it so wet?
You know, it's just been the pattern. We've been in a super active pattern, and you need something to break that down. And we really have just not gotten a break. There's no real meteorological reason that I can explain exactly why a pattern develops and, you know, what it takes to break one down. But we've just been in it because it's a whole global thing, right? Depends on what's happening on the other side of the world as well. That also affects our pattern here.
Well, and I know whenever someone hears a story like this, they're wondering, is this related to climate change?
I know. That's what a lot of people want to say. I mean, and you can't just say one event is, you know, related to climate change. But the more and more big flood events that we get are going to point towards climate change, because climate means more extremes with everything, right? Dry or dry, wet or wet.
The holiday weekend is upon us. A lot of people will want to know what's in store for them. Not great news. It sounds like it's going to be hot in the southeast and more rain and thunderstorms.
Exactly. So Midwest and Plains, again, this huge high pressure over the southeast, it is going to bake. I mean, we're talking a heat wave for days, and it's not going to break down until the end of May. And so it's going to stay very hot and dry in the southeast, and then it's just going to be everything riding around the plains in the Midwest, riding around that ridge. So unfortunately, like Chicago, those areas, I mean, it's going to be cool and damp for the weekend, unfortunately.
We're seeing that heat records back from the late 1800s and early 1900s could fall over the weekend. So yes, lots of extreme weather going on. That's Stephanie Abrams, meteorologist for the Weather Channel. Thanks so much.
Sure, thank you.
Well, Peter mentioned climate change. According to unnamed past and current officials at the EPA, that agency plans to change the way it calculates the health risks of air pollution, which in turn would help justify the Trump administration's goal of rolling back an Obama-era climate change rule. The New York Times is reporting that the agency's new math equation would calculate fewer predicted deaths related to air pollution, and that in turn could justify fewer restrictions on polluters. Let's bring in Eric Schaefer. He's head of the Environmental Integrity Project. That's an environmental nonprofit group. He's also a former enforcement official with the EPA. And Eric, your reaction when you read about this proposed change?
I don't like it. I think it's a case where the administration wants to get to an endpoint, which is relaxing anti-pollution standards and a rule that would help clean up power plants and reduce carbon emissions from power plants. And they're baking the science to justify that result.
Well, you're not the only one saying that, but it would help us understand here. This has to do with particulate matter. These are these tiny microscopic pieces of matter that are in pollution from, say, coal plants that, when inhaled, can be harmful. The agency sets a standard which is considered safe for the amount of emissions of this particulate matter. But within that safe area, it also looks for health risks. This is what many in the Trump administration and the current head of the EPA, who was, by the way, a coal lobbyist, they are against. Why look for something that's dangerous within a safe level? But thankfully, somebody compared this to speed limits. So can you help us by understanding how that helps us understand why it's important to look for danger within a safe area?
Sure. I mean, people understand that it's usually safer to drive 30 miles an hour in, let's say, a residential area than it is to drive 60 miles an hour. But driving 30 miles an hour doesn't eliminate any risk that you might have an accident or run over a child, let's say, in a school zone. So, you know, there's no zero risk when it comes to driving. You know, drive slower speed limits, that's safer, but it doesn't mean that there aren't any risks. So the prevailing science is that there isn't, at least today, based on our scientific understanding, a safe level of exposure to fine particles. You know, the government has set an air quality standard that it wants to meet, and it wants to drive emissions down so we at least meet that air quality standard for fine particles. But that's not based on the idea that exposure to fine particles just below that standard is safe. The assumption, in fact, is, you know, the risk is the relationship between the exposure to fine particles and the death and disease that result from exposure to that pollutant is linear. And I can explain that with a simple example. If you're in a big metropolitan area and you have a given level of fine particle pollution and the science predicts that you'll get 300 premature deaths a year from exposure to that pollution. And then you cut that fine particle level by a third. The assumption today is that you would reduce those premature deaths by a third. So instead of 300, you'd have 200. Mm. Well, that's clearly better. It's not zero.
Mm. What would you like to see happen now? The agency seems to be headed to implementing this new equation, therefore predicting fewer deaths from this particulate matter, therefore enabling the Trump administration to overturn some climate change rules. What's another option?
So when it comes to science, the ends don't justify the means. The way you make decisions is very important. It's legitimate to ask the scientific question, is there some threshold of exposure to fine particle pollution where we don't see any health effects? That's a fair question to ask. So far, EPA hasn't been able to identify that, and the assumption is risks will decline as fine particle levels decline, but they aren't eliminated. Mm. You know, they're always there as long as we have fine particles in the air. So if the administration wants to challenge that science or review it, they have every right to do that. They should put it on a scientific track, provide for peer review, allow for public comment. This is what EPA does when it reviews the scientific assumptions behind health-based air quality standards. What they shouldn't do is, you know, rush to bake up some science so they can justify a rollback in a rule they don't like. That's not how you're supposed to do it. But the science on exposure to fine particles is very, very strong. It's based on decades of review. Even this administration isn't arguing that, you know, the standards in place that already aren't needed. You get tens of thousands of premature deaths nationally if you're above the current standard. And again, the assumption is just you can drive exposures below that standard, you'll have fewer deaths, but there'll still be thousands of them.
Yeah. That's Eric Schaefer, head of the Environmental Integrity Project. That's an environmental nonprofit, but he was an enforcement official with the EPA. Eric, thank you.
Thank you so much.
And a quick look at other environmental news. Xcel Energy in Minneapolis, a major utility, announced this week that it will close its two remaining coal-fired power plants in Minnesota a decade earlier than planned as part of an agreement with environmental groups. This will keep the company on track to be coal-free by 2030. And in exchange, Xcel hopes to continue to operate a nuclear plant in the region through at least 2040 while it expands wind and solar energy, instead of closing that plant 10 years earlier in 2030 as planned. Boy, there are a lot of fireworks in Washington today. First, House Speaker Nancy Pelosi came out of this morning's meeting on impeachment with House Democrats and said they felt the president was undertaking a cover-up. Then a couple hours later, an angry President Trump walked out of a White House meeting on infrastructure with Pelosi and Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer and said, among other things, this.
Instead of walking in happily into a meeting, I walk in to look at people that had just said that I was doing a cover-up. I don't do cover-ups.
Well, Pelosi then came out of what was supposed to be the infrastructure meeting at the White House and said this.
He just took a pass, and it just makes me wonder why he did that. In any event, I pray for the president of the United States.
And Pelosi later spoke at a public event saying the president in plain sight is obstructing justice and engaged in a cover-up that could be impeachable.
So today got very interesting, yeah. Very fast. Let's bring in our political roundtable. Jamal Simmons is a Democratic strategist. Hey, Jamal.
Hi, how are you?
Pretty well, thanks. And then Alice Stewart, our Republican strategist. Alice, it's good to have you.
Great to be here. Thank you, Peter and Robin. Mm.
Sure. And why don't we rewind just a little bit and start with the words of Nancy Pelosi that got all of this started today.
We do believe that it's important to follow the facts. We believe that no one is above the law, including the President of the United States. And we believe that the President of the United States is engaged in a cover-up.
Jamal, let's start with you. Nancy Pelosi is a shrewd politician. She had to have known what was going to happen in the infrastructure meeting soon after she said that. What was her strategy, and did she make a misstep?
Oh, I don't think she made a misstep. What Nancy Pelosi is trying to do is keep a pretty raucous caucus in line. There are a lot of people in the Democratic side of the House who want to impeach the president. She's trying to show them that she's a fellow traveler. She actually is trying to hold the president accountable, but she wants to slow the process down, have some ways of making it work.
Now, the president speeded it up today, to be honest, Jamal.
Well, it depends on how fast you think the caucus is moving. And I'll tell you, I think that the politics on the Democratic side are moving pretty fast, and she's trying to stay in front of that train. And what the president did today in response is going to make this very hard, because ultimately this is a power play. And this is the president saying, either you're going to succumb to my will or you're going to have to do something to fight me back.
Alice,
neither one of them are great options.
Well, I was going to say, Alice, do you agree? Because the president might also be saying to his base, and he came out of the White House and went on a rant about phone calls that his son was supposed to have made, and it was actually a real estate. I mean, he tried to redo the whole last year of investigation, just throwing out tons of stuff. But I'm imagining to his base, they are seeing him as a victim.
Absolutely. And they have seen him that way throughout this entire investigation, which he constantly referred to as a witch hunt and the phony investigation and discrediting the FBI. His base and many in the Republican Party have agreed with his characterization of this Mueller report from the very beginning, and they truly believe the Mueller report reached the correct conclusion. And this is a calculation on both sides, both the Democrats and the president on this. President Trump is looking at the number 56. 56% of Americans do not want to seek impeachment. Mm-hmm. They realize that is too disruptive to this country. However, we have the Democrats who are looking at this from the standpoint that they are frustrated with the outcome of the Mueller report. They do believe that there was certainly obstruction of justice, and many also believe there was collusion and coordination and conspiracy on the part of the Trump campaign, and they do believe he should be removed from office. But in my view, it's a calculation on both sides. And if Democrats are truly frustrated with the activity of the president and the campaign, then let the voters decide. Let the voters make the right decision that they want, who they want in office come 2020. And that's the best way to resolve this.
Well, there's an argument on the Democratic side that the voters did decide. The voters elected a Democratic House to hold the president accountable. And the question that just nags at me is, how do you hold the president accountable if you don't want to remove him from office? And what Republicans on the Hill, other than Justin Amash, who to me seems like the only Republican patriot left on the Hill because he's willing to sacrifice himself in order to do what's best for the country, which is the definition of patriotism, what is the way that those Republicans want to hold the president accountable for his behavior short of impeachment?
But Alice, now look where we are. We've gotten to the point where the president has said there will be no work that gets done until they get off of the Democrats get off of this investigation track. Do you agree that that is good for the country?
I think what's best for the country is to go about the business of electing officials that will do the business of the country, that is making laws, passing laws, and enacting the will of the people. Unfortunately, what we had today was basically a political version of the childish game, I know you are, but what am I?
Yeah.
Nancy Pelosi says, you're engaged in a cover-up, and the president says, I don't do cover-ups. You're engaging in phony investigations. That's not helping the American people. And I would hope at some point one side is going to have to blink, because we cannot go between now and Election Day without anything getting done.
Well, you're our strategist. So, Jamal, how much of this can you see was strategy? I mean, Trump is saying that the Democrats tricked him by having their impeachment meeting before this infrastructure meeting. Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer is saying Trump purposely blew up the infrastructure meeting. Great, because that's a way for him to cite the morning meeting and do what he always wanted to do and walk out because he doesn't want to pay for infrastructure. So is there a strategy here, or was this just a kind of like a accidental blow up?
I think on the president side, you have to look at Donald Trump as a whole, with some whole vision here. And he is always doing what is best for Donald Trump's political purpose. And I suggest to all of your listeners to go back and watch the opening scene of the movie Patton, where Patton is standing in front of that flag talking about fighting. That will tell you everything you need to know about
Donald Trump's approach.
Well, what Patton says is you don't die for your country. You make the other SOB die for his. And you just keep moving forward all the time. Don't hold the line. Keep taking ground. And I think when you look at that and even the way he stands there, you will see a lot of refreshers of how Donald Trump seems to behave in public. It'll make sense to you. My point here is that—
his supporters will be saying, yes, and that's a good thing.
Of course they will. But is it good for the country? At some point, I think that's the question that we all have to ask. And I think that's the question that a lot of Democrats— who, of course, there's politics in this for Democrats. I'm not naive here. But there is a question about whether or not we want to have a presidency that can't be checked by Congress. And I think that is the result of Donald Trump's political ploy, is that either the Congress has to succumb to the fact the president can't be have oversight from the Congress, or there's going to be something that's even more dramatic, like an impeachment inquiry.
Alice?
Well, look, I think what it boils down to is right now— this will, more than anything, embolden President Trump's base. This will get them more engaged. This will fire them up. And what he will do, and I expect he will do, I know he is planning to do, is continue to travel around this country, hold rallies, and get his base engaged. I would like to think that part of the strategy, too, is to broaden the base and bring in people that may not be engaged in politics and may not have come out in the midterms. Because what he will be able to do masterfully is be able to paint what happened today and paint what Democrats are doing as refusing to get anything done, obstructing the business of legislating and spending more time, obviously, as he has said, on investigating as opposed to legislating. That will be a powerful tool for him as he goes out on the campaign trail and encouraging his base and others to come out and support him, not just him, but also other Republicans in 2020 so they can get things done. Obviously, right now with the divided Congress, it makes it very difficult, but that will be his message moving forward.
In fact, he was out traveling the country. Here is the president in Pennsylvania on Monday night, and he's talking about Joe Biden's home state.
This guy talks about, oh, I know Scranton, I know that. Well, I know the place is better. He left you for another state, and he didn't take care of you because he didn't take care of your jobs.
Alice, Joe Biden, if he eventually becomes the nominee, and Donald Trump will be fighting for white, blue-collar voters, and that is perhaps some of the base that you're talking about as well that the president needs to keep. How does he do it? What's he need to do?
He goes out there, as he has done many times very well, both sides, and engage and connect with the Rust Belt and the blue-collar workers of America and say, I am with you, I am for you, I will fight for you. Here's the challenge that Joe Biden has. If the economy is still strong as it is now and unemployment is at a good rate, the GDP is high, President Trump can and will own that as he is campaigning. It is one thing to say, I am fighting for you, I will fight for you, which is what Joe Biden will do. And the president can show actual concrete evidence of the policies that he has put into place and say, this is what I've been able to do in the first 4 years, and us together can do more in the next 4 years. So that will be a powerful tool for the president to use economy is strong.
We have about a minute left, Jamal. Just as you look at the 97 people who are on the Democratic side running for president, Beto O'Rourke trying to reset his campaign. You've got Elizabeth Warren not going on Fox TV, Bernie Sanders criticizing Biden for pursuing big donors in like a half a minute. What are you watching?
Oh, I'm watching Elizabeth Warren because I think she is the one leader out of the group. I think that's the – if you take a look back from the tiles and look at the entire mosaic, what you see is Elizabeth Warren making real leadership strides. I also will just tell you, pay attention to the voters that Democrats have to go after. It's not just the guy with the lunch pail at the diner having a cup of coffee. It's the person serving him the coffee. Right. That woman that's in that diner that Democrats really need to go.
Jamal Simmons and Alice Stewart, thanks to you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Here and Now and the following message is supported by Daily Harvest. Daily Harvest delivers carefully sourced, chef-crafted smoothies, soups, harvest bowls, overnight oats, and more, all built on fruits and vegetables. Each single serving cup can be prepared in minutes. Daily Harvest is designed for convenience, so you can load up on fruits and vegetables first thing in the morning, before bed, and anytime in between. Learn more about Daily Harvest and get 3 free cups in your first box at dailyharvest.com/now.
It's going to be crowded. Nearly 43 million Americans plan to travel this Memorial Day weekend. That's the second largest crowd. And this summer, airline travel is expected to increase 3.5%. Where will we put all of those travelers? Seth Kaplan is Here Now's transportation analyst. Hi, Seth.
Hi, Robin.
So even though gas prices are nearing the $3 mark, more Americans will drive to their destinations this Memorial Day. There's this, people have done multipliers, like you can see how your trip will be multiplied in the Boston area 3 times, in Atlanta 2.2 times longer. Talk about where people are headed.
Orlando, New York, and Las Vegas. That, according to AAA, those are the top 3 destinations. As you mentioned, that despite these higher gas prices. Now, on the other hand, sort of historically speaking, if you adjust for inflation, gas prices up from where they were last year, but not all that high in historical terms. Not only that, AAA says that hotels and rental cars are actually cheaper this year than they were last year. So that kind of offsetting the impact for some travelers of the higher gas prices.
I can't believe that 3.25 million people, 4.8% more than last year, second only to 2005, are going to be flying. The airports are already packed. The flights are already packed.
They are. And, you know, somehow airlines are going to add seats this summer.
Where?
It's hard to do, especially, Robin, consider that you have 75 Boeing 737 MAXs on the ground that they expected to have in the air. So if you're an airline, you know, you can't just go out and suddenly buy or lease a lot of new airplanes. What you can do, and this is what they do when demand is really high, you know, that last flight late at night or an early flight in the morning that they might not fly when people, you know, when demand is lower, they'll put those flights back in, and they'll delay the retirement of older aircraft. So planes that, you know, they thought they were going to kind of get out of the fleet, they can hang on to them a little while longer, and that's really the only way they can do it.
And what about delays? We know American Airlines mechanics are engaged in tough contract negotiations. Sometimes there can be delays. Some would call them slowdowns. The Boeing MAX is still grounded, and the Trump administration is diverting Customs and Border Protection officers from airports to the border. So it sounds like, you know, the combination of those things and the increased travel could be a hot mess.
It does. You have all the elements of that. And we've had really messy summers in the past. On the other hand, we've had summers where it all looked bad like this. And then in the end, it really wasn't so bad. A couple of years ago, TSA said it was badly understaffed. And in the end, it just kind of wasn't all that bad. So we'll see how this works out. But yeah, with all of that you mentioned the American Airlines mechanics being accused of slowing things down beyond even where they are. At least Southwest mechanics just ratified their deal months after being accused of the same thing.
But just a second on Boeing. We hear officials are debating whether it could have been a bird strike, a bird hitting the sensor system that caused the plane to nosedive in the Indonesia and Ethiopian crashes because it, you know, tipped off that system we've talked a lot about. But yeah. I just find it fascinating. So many more people are flying. And, you know, a few months ago, people were calling up to ask, what kind of plane am I flying on? Now it seems like maybe some of those worries are gone.
If Boeing and the FAA and airlines can restore confidence here in the MAX, which is going to take time, remarkable that a bird strike might have caused that single sensor, yet another reason why you would want the system to rely on the readings from two sensors, not just one. They're working on that.
Seth Kaplan, Here Now's transportation analyst. It's going to be busy. Thank you so much, Seth.
Thank you, Robin.
Starting tomorrow, voters in 28 European countries will head to the polls for a historic election. The European Union parliamentary vote is normally a pretty low-key affair, but this year it could determine the future of the bloc because the United Kingdom's messy break from the EU is causing all sorts of uncertainty. The BBC's Adam Fleming is in Brussels. Adam, thanks for speaking with us.
You're very welcome.
British voters weren't even supposed to be participating in this election, but here they are because there is no deal yet to leave the EU. What's the sense there of what's at stake with this election?
You're absolutely right that the UK wasn't supposed to be taking part in these elections, and the Prime Minister, Theresa May, said over and over again they wouldn't happen. But because the UK is still a member of the European Union, it is obliged, as a well-behaving member state, to give British citizens their right as EU citizens to elect members of the European Parliament. So that's why they're happening. In terms of how the public feel, I don't think they're particularly energised. The vox pops you hear on TV and radio, the main point people make is, why am I doing this? Mm. However, the political system has really energized that in all sorts of crazy new ways.
And there is a new party, the Brexit Party, which is expected to do quite well in this election.
The Brexit Party are polling well, and of course they're opinion polls, so they're just snapshots of opinion. And of course they're a new party, so you can't compare their performance with the past. So the polls have actually been quite unpredictable for all the parties, and you get quite a big range of results from different polling companies. But some of the themes are that the two traditional main parties, Labour, who are the opposition, and the Conservatives, who are the government, they are doing much less well in the polls than they've done in the past. Then you've got the Liberal Democrats and the Greens, who are very pro-European, anti-Brexit parties, doing slightly better than you might have expected them to do, considering the state of politics at the moment. And then you've got another new party, Change UK, who are campaigning for a second referendum. So they're making an appearance in the polls as well. So it's quite a confusing picture at the moment. And it won't be cleared up, because even though we're voting in the UK on Thursday, and normally you then have everyone staying up late watching TV, for the results. They don't come out till Sunday night,
right,
when the other EU countries have finished their voting.
Yesterday, French President Emmanuel Macron accused President Trump's former strategist Steve Bannon and Russian oligarchs of conspiring with Europe's nationalists to dismantle the EU. So it's not just Britain that has these nationalist party. How much traction are other candidates gaining across the continent?
Oh, that is the big story as far as these elections are concerned in the non-Brexit part of the EU. In other words, the other 27 member states. The big story that everyone is focusing on is how are these anti-EU parties, loosely called populists or populist nationalists, how well are they going to do in the elections? And will you see a big block of anti-EU parties working together in the European Parliament to thwart progress on the European project, because that's what those parties are threatening to do.
Right. If they gain seats as expected, how does that change an institution that was founded on the exact opposite concept, the idea of European unity?
Right. You're ready for your political science part of this conversation about how the European Parliament works. So you have the national political parties, but they coalesce with other national parties that share their worldview into big political groups. So in the past, the Parliament has been dominated by the centre-right, known as the EPP, and the centre-left, known as the Socialists and Democrats. Together, they had more than 50% of the seats, so they could work together to get business through.
And they were pro-Europe.
And they were pro-European, very mainstream, very EU establishment. And then the other big groups were the Greens and the Liberals, and then you had a smaller group of Eurosceptics, and then other assorted Eurosceptic groups as well, and the extreme left and the extreme Greens. But it meant, though, that the mainstream had a stranglehold on business getting through. Now, what everyone is talking about now is, could you have the third largest group being people like Matteo Salvini's League Party from Italy or Marine Le Pen's National Rally from France, people who want to really, really change the European architecture. However, you could have loads of people voting for anti-EU parties, but you end up with a strengthened pro-EU majority in the chamber as a result.
Tell me more about the pro-EU parties here. I know there's a lot of tensions. People are throwing milkshakes at Nigel Farage, for example, the Brexit Party leader. There still are a lot of people who are pro-Europe in Europe.
Oh, yes. And I mean, they do lots of opinion polls. They're known as Eurobarometers. And they have shown support for the EU creeping up in most countries ever since the Brexit referendum. Now, is that a result of Brexit and people are looking in horror, shock horror, at what's happening in the UK? Or is it just that the perennial crises of migration and national finances and the economy that have gripped Europe in the last few years have come to an end? And so people are feeling a bit more comfortable, though there are some outliers there. I mean, the country that stands out where support for the EU seems to be lowest is Italy. And Italy keeps on coming up as the country where there are real, real antagonisms against the EU.
That's the BBC's Adam Fleming in Brussels. Thanks very much for your time.
You're very welcome.
And back here in the U.S., recent school shootings have many administrators taking a hard look at their security plans. But there isn't any clear evidence as to what programs and technology work best to keep schools safe. Aditi Bundlamudi from member station WUNC tells us how one North Carolina school district is wading through their options.
Talk to parents dropping their kids off at school, and they'll tell you they're thinking about security.
I think for school safety, you know, you can't really put a dollar on it.
Well, my kid's safe. That's my opinion. I don't think we need to make a business out of it, but we should keep our kids safe.
In 2017, the market for school security systems was worth $2.7 billion, according to IHS Market, a research firm. There are endless products, from $60 door locks that can withstand a sledgehammer, to video surveillance and metal detectors, to classroom tourniquet kits, and special toilets schools can buy for long lockdowns.
You buy these 5-gallon buckets that has a toilet seat on it and a roll of paper towel, of toilet paper, and you can
sanitary like, wipes.
And yeah, there's like this package that you can buy.
That's Tracy Fowler and Chris Blyce. Fowler is the director of student services and support programs for the Chatham County School District in North Carolina. Blyce is the chief operations officer for the district. Chatham County schools realized they needed to change their security plan in November 2017 when a hunter shot a deer near one of the schools.
Teacher called and the school went into lockdown. Well, this was at about 7:45, and the kids were just getting there. So there's a line of cars down the front of the school and out to the road. So what do you do about that? And who does it?
And the following February, two Chatham County schools were placed on lockdown when someone stole a vehicle and came near the schools. It became apparent to Blythe and Fowler that they needed to revamp their security system. But when they started looking, the options seemed endless and expensive.
I mean, it's overwhelming. I mean, it really is. There's more stuff out there than you could ever use.
There's a lot we don't know about which types of technology are effective in making schools safer, yet there's an abundance of types of technology for school districts to wade through.
Heather Schwartz is a senior policy researcher at Rand Corporation. She co-wrote a recent study published by Rand and found no evidence that increased technology or security programs reduce firearm violence in schools. Schwartz found that most tech for lockdowns is reactive rather than proactive to school violence. And she says it's difficult to study what technology works well, particularly because factors change depending on the school, how big the school is, what safety procedures the school already follows, and how closely staff follow those procedures. So what are schools supposed to do?
You need to think about the whole picture. Training staff on your policies, deciding what particular policies to implement, and what technologies in this case, and then how are you going to maintain it over time.
Blythe and Fowler in Chatham County followed that approach. And for Blythe, it's not about the stuff, it's about communication and organization.
It's finding the balance and it's understanding that these are things that help you. They can't be where you're putting your faith.
Ultimately, they mostly want more eyes around the school. They have over 700 security cameras throughout their school district, but they want to add more. They added 4 additional school resource officers to their squad of 7. They're in the process of replacing the physical locks on their doors with badges and a computerized system which updates who has access. They're also looking into a program which would call law enforcement faster. Blythe says preparing for an active shooter is like preparing for a plane crash. On the rare occasion that it happens, we question our safety in some of the safest places.
We're training hoping that we never have an airplane crash, and we're doing everything that we can so that if we have one, we can get through it. That's about the best we can do.
For Here and Now, I'm Aditi Bandlamudi.
And Aditi's story comes to us from the reporting project Guns in America.
Police get jobbing in door. Gnama seat light jardin. Delpit dowsin.
That's Emma Stevens, a 16-year-old 10th grader at Chief Allison Bernard Memorial High School on Cape Breton in Nova Scotia, Canada, singing the Beatles' Blackbird in Mi'kmaq, which is sometimes pronounced Mi'kmaq, in a video that went viral. The song was translated by Katani Julian, who works in language revitalization for the Eskasoni First Nation, of which Emma is a member. It's part of an effort to raise awareness about Indigenous language and culture. And it's interesting because Paul McCartney was inspired to write that song by women in the civil rights movement in the U.S. in the 1960s. In a moment, we'll bring in Katani Julian to talk about translating the song. But first, Emma, who sings it in Mi'kmaq. Emma, tell us about your language.
My language is very different from other ones. There's a lot of syllables in ours, and there's a lot of long words that translate into something really easy in English.
So give me a sense. Blackbirds singing in the dead of night. So say that in Mi'kmaq, please.
Purilisquiajwabaninto.
Wow. Why do you think it's important? Obviously, it's important for your friends and family to preserve it. But tell us more about preserving it. Are there young people who aren't speaking it? Are you afraid that it may disappear?
Yes. There are a lot of kids. There's a school around here that they teach little kids how to speak Mi'kmaq. And once you get older, you kind of can't go there anymore. So you're stuck with like speaking English. Mm-hmm. And a lot of kids didn't have the opportunity to learn it. So there's not a lot of them that speak Mi'kmaq now.
This song means so many things to so many people. What does it mean to you? What does it feel like when you sing those words?
I don't know. It makes me feel proud. Like, singing in my language, there's not a lot of people who can do that. So it makes me feel really proud to be able to do those kind of things.
Was this difficult to translate, Katani?
A lot of songs that are originate in English are hard to translate. Sometimes you have a concept that is several syllables in Mi'kmaq, but it's a whole sentence in English, or the other way around. So the struggle would be to get the beat and the rhythm of the song into the appropriate amount of signals for the music.
What did you think when you actually heard it? To us, it's so beautiful.
Well, it has an impact before because, you know, Paul McCartney is such a brilliant songwriter. And, of course, it has impact and deep meaning already. But then to add the icing on the cake and to have it done in our Mi'kmaq language is just spectacular. It's just wonderful to hear it. And Mi'kmaq is full of emotions when it's spoken, you know, when we speak to each other. There's a lot of emotion that's conveyed in the words. And so it just took that song up to an extra heightened level of emotion. And a lot of people who understand and speak Mi'kmaq were brought to tears when they heard the song.
Yeah. And by the way, you say the song has a story anyway. Were you aware that Paul McCartney was inspired by women in the Little Rock Nine who bravely integrated an all-white school in 1957? That was his inspiration for the song.
Yes, I know that now. But before, you know, I have had some experience in studying literature in my past and reading between the lines of poetry and lyrics and to look for a deeper meaning. And there's always, even though the Beatles songs sound, you know, simple, there's always a hidden meaning in there.
Yeah.
And that's what I really loved about it. And so I had to really do it very carefully so that I got the message, the original message across in Mi'kmaq as well.
Your sense, too, of, you know, here's this young woman doing this. It's got to be a lot of pride.
Oh, yeah. What really strikes me is the opportunities that the young people have in our community in this day and age, you know? Like, when I was her age, I certainly didn't have access to this. I didn't even have a school in my community. Now, we do have high school in our community, and within recent years, we've gotten a music program, and the children they're just absolutely blossoming, yeah. And I'm so proud of them.
Well, and then because of social media, are you surprised at how this song just took off on social media?
When I first saw the video, like I was really impressed and I was really emotional. I showed it to my father. My father helped me translate it. He's 77 years old, and he had tears in his eyes at the end, and my heart was just beating so fast, and I had such a rush of adrenaline, and I don't know what it feels like to be on stage and have a bunch of people applaud for you, but I imagine that that's what it feels like when I first heard that song.
That was Ketani Julian, language and culture consultant for the Eskasoni School Board, and you must see Emma Stevens singing Blackbird in Mi'kmaq at hereandnow.org. Here Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Peter O'Dowd. It's Here and Now.
Don't was the take bonic bike too.